As more Canadian provinces open up vaccination for youth and adults, it's easy to think we're on the road to eliminating COVID-19.
Looking south of the border to the US or across the pond to the UK and Israel, getting first and second shots in the arms is driving down new cases and deaths.
But being a worldwide pandemic, COVID-19 isn't going to give up without a fight. I'm Adam Toy.
And I'm Dave McIver, and this is Why.
At the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, many hoped it would be a temporary inconvenience.
A year and a half after it was first identified, COVID-19 remains a part of our life, with some end in sight as vaccinations roll out across the country.
In a recent survey by Nature magazine of 100 immunologists, infectious disease researchers, and virologists working on the coronavirus, found that 90% thought COVID-19 would become endemic.
And what does that mean, Adam? Well, we bring back an expert we've previously had on This Is Why.
Cynthia Carr, epidemiologist and founder of Epi Research Incorporated in Winnipeg, Manitoba.
The question that we're trying to figure out today is why could COVID-19 become endemic and stick around for years? But let's start with just some basic terminologies. There's the word endemic, the word pandemic, what's the third one that I was thinking of?
Epidemic, outbreak. Eradicated.
Epidemic. That was the other one. Okay. The other emic. So endemic, epidemic, pandemic. What are the differences?
So endemic means that a disease is circulating in the population. It might be seasonal. And you might have years where you have lots of that virus or disease in the population and years where you don't. So the common cold. That's an example of a illness that is endemic in the population. We don't have a vaccine for it. We don't really have a good treatment for it. We just have to kind of get through it. And year to year, the common colds come back and they're caused by different viruses. So that's an example of an endemic virus. An epidemic is when there is technically, we would say statistically, a higher number of cases than you would expect. So certainly when there's a brand new virus, one case is an alert that an epidemic is occurring because this is a newly generated virus for which we probably don't have immunity for, which is what occurred with COVID-19. So an epidemic can occur in certain areas. So it kind of starts from a case to a cluster, so a small group, and then could be an outbreak within that community getting bigger. And then an epidemic is the numbers are getting larger. The pandemic is not really a mathematical model so much as a concept that the epidemic that might have started, say, in Kingston, Ontario, is now in London, England. That same virus is in London, England. It could be associated with somebody from Kingston went to London and they brought the virus with them. So that's not yet a pandemic. What becomes a pandemic is if that virus starts to spread within the communities. And that's when it was triggered in March of 2020. It looks like this is a true pandemic because there's community spread occurring globally and it couldn't be mapped back now to individual travelers.
Here in Canada, in the States, parts of Europe, we're seeing more and more vaccines being rolled out. What role does immunization have in eliminating any virus or any disease?
Vaccine is an extremely important intervention to move us toward a disease becoming a preventable disease. That doesn't mean the disease has been eradicated. It doesn't mean it's been eliminated, but it means it's being controlled and that we could be on the path to elimination and eradication of that disease. So absolutely, the global goal is to make COVID-19 a preventable illness through vaccination. Just a note that people might not know, there's only been one disease, smallpox, since 1980 that's been declared as eradicated, a human virus in the world that's been declared eradicated by the World Health Organization. Eradication is very tricky. It requires both a vaccine and a treatment. And it's much more difficult to eradicate a disease when it's in both a human and an animal reservoir. So the virus, if it can live in animals and it can live in humans, such as influenza, such as COVID-19, it's even more difficult to eradicate it because we don't know what's happening in the animal population in terms of controlling it. And then again, what we see over time is a human can come in contact with an animal that may have that illness, and then it can kind of inflame it again. So the concept of eliminate is different from eradicate. So we can certainly eliminate a disease from circulation. So there are certain areas in the world right now that seem to have really firm control that you would almost say right now it's eliminated from circulating in the area, but that doesn't mean it's eradicated. And then control is kind of somewhere in the middle. You don't think you've really eliminated it, but you've got control of it. So a real world example, for example, could be, polio, which is still found in a very, very small number of places in the world. So we can't say it's eradicated, but it's certainly eliminated from Canada. We don't see that in Canada. So that's an example where you could see circulation in different areas of the world, even on a very small level, and other areas of the world could say we've actually eliminated those diseases from circulation. And then other examples would be control. Certain countries have better control, for example, of HIV than is occurring still in Africa, where there is not control of HIV. So that's still an epidemic of urgency in that country, whereas other countries have been able to control that, again, through not through vaccination, but through treatment and public health kind of information.
So those three terms you used, control, elimination, and eradication, those are three varying degrees of handling the virus, for lack of a better verb, where eradication is completely gone, zero. Elimination is minimal amount, and control is maybe more controlling the spread and preventing major disease, major outbreaks?
Yeah, you might have small outbreaks, but you get in control of it quickly. It doesn't get that inflamed community spread again. So those are the layers. But again, eradication, even, you know, a disease, if you think of chickenpox, where our understanding is if you come in contact with the child, you have lifelong immunity. You can get vaccinated for chickenpox. It is still not declared eradicated. We still haven't gotten rid of it because there are still targets and opportunities for the disease to spread. We know that, for example, SARS in 2003-04, which is one of the coronaviruses, there was a very serious situation, but it seemed to kind of flame out fast too. But we cannot say that SARS is eradicated because we don't know why. We don't know what happened that we stopped seeing it spread. So again, it could still be in an animal reservoir somewhere. It could pop up again. So even something that we haven't seen, we can't call it eradicated.
You mentioned chickenpox. That's an example of an endemic disease that's still circulating here. And measles has been largely suppressed in Canada thanks to vaccination. But sometimes you hear about measles outbreaks in schools, for example.
And that's an example to your point about measles of a serious situation. So that when we, again, when we had clusters, for example, in New York City of people in a particular cultural community that didn't believe in vaccination, they gave the measles an opportunity to spread like wildfire within that small group that then could spread. So it wasn't like there was one person here and another person far away that kind of randomly hadn't been vaccinated. The most dangerous situation is when you have a group of people that interact regularly, all of whom are at risk for disease, because it just takes one and then it spreads. And then you've got even more people opportunity to spread to sort of those random people that haven't been vaccinated.
Right now with COVID-19, we're using vaccinations to try to stop the spread and hopefully stop the severity of the disease. As more of these vaccinations go out, what are you aware of some of the signposts that we should be looking for vaccination of a population to move maybe from that community spread that that is characteristic of a pandemic more towards endemic COVID, and then even more maybe even towards complete eradication? What are some of those major milestones that in vaccination that we could be looking for?
It was challenging to give sort of a proportional of the population because the concept of herd immunity is actually a mathematical calculation that's not that complicated. But what makes it challenging is part of the model is the reproductive rate. So again, just to keep it simple, if I can infect one other person, that will keep the virus going. If we can get that reproductive rate down under one, either by vaccination or distancing, so that I can infect less than one person, that virus will run out of targets. It won't have anywhere to go and to spread. What happens though now with the variants of concern and that increased transmissibility is that compared to the former version of COVID-19 we were dealing with, even with the B117, right in the beginning in the United Kingdom, what they saw was people in exactly the same environment that person with B117 could spread to 1.6 people compared to the 1-to-1 as an example spread with the regular version. So as the reproductive rate or the ability to transmit gets higher, the proportion of the population that we have to vaccinate for safety, that also keeps going up. We have to now vaccinate more and more people to reduce the numbers of targets for this virus that's really good at spreading. So that's why it might seem confusing to people that, you know, we heard 70%, we heard 80%, we heard 90%. Why does it keep changing? It keeps changing because we've given this virus a real momentum. And with momentum, it's given, it gets opportunities. Once it gets into every body and makes millions and millions of copies, there's going to be mutations. And sometimes those mutations, they really work in favor of the virus, and that's what they hold on to. So, you know, what we can do, though, is we can look at countries like the United Kingdom and Israel that had both a very efficient vaccination program while they held fast to their mitigation measures. And we can see that, you know, a country like Israel that in January was still having around 7,000 cases a day in a population of about 8 million people, now they're down to about 50 cases a day. Our country was having similar numbers of cases a day at that point, and now we've reduced our cases by maybe 1,000. So you can see that the faster you get people vaccinated and you keep those layers of protection in place, the faster you will see a reduction in hospitalization and deaths, but also that the true number of cases, which will allow you to get back to normal.
Through this past year and change, I've been reminded of, you know, from high school, I think biology, where I first learned about, you know, the difference between a bacteria and a virus, and the fact that the virus can't live outside of the host. The virus needs us in order to live. And so, and as you said earlier, all of these variants come from random changes from that replication process, from that duplication process. I'm wondering if as time passes on and as it takes us time to vaccinate 6 billion people on this earth, the virus will change. There will be more variants. This is, you know, a statistical inevitability, but I'm wondering if, how this virus could change. I've read that there are some thoughts that it could decrease in severity. And the logic behind that is that the virus needs the host in order to stay alive. So it needs to strike that balance between being infectious, but also not killing the host.
Absolutely. It's just like thinking, why would you burn your own house down? That's exactly the analogy, that the virus wants to be able to continue to thrive and continue to spread throughout the population. The last thing it wants to do is kill the host. That's where you get these very rare but serious illnesses with high mortality rates, which is terrible. But the only good news about that is they really can't spread far because the hosts don't live. What has made this particularly challenging, even compared to the influenza virus, is this long incubation period. Because even with influenza, within a day or two, you are sick and you know it. So you're staying away from people, you're not out and about, you're not going to work, you're going to the doctor, you're seeking care. And of course, we've had vaccine campaigns, particularly for our vulnerable populations. But more to the point about spread is even in our worst influenza years, we haven't seen it be just so difficult to contain. And it is because of this asymptomatic spread, and that you don't, even if you do get symptoms, it can take several days. And in the worst case about this is you're actually the most infectious in the 2 days before you develop any symptoms. So that's why we can't talk about trust and I feel fine and that person's fine. It's not about trust. It's literally to just to your defense in making decisions, you won't know you have it until it's too late, that you've already passed it on to other people. So that's why it's so important to follow the public health directives. We know how to stop the spread of this. We need to follow those rules.
Cynthia, taking a peek at the Public Health Agency of Canada's website, we're still in the single-digit percentage of Canadians who have been fully vaccinated, the amount of Canadians who have had two shots. And the worldwide number is still pretty low as well. We're still very early on in this process. I'm wondering if you can speak to the challenge of vaccinating the entire world to help drive down the spread and move towards control, towards elimination, towards eradication of COVID-19?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because we're really kind of, we can get caught up in looking at our own backyard and thinking about just Canada or ourselves. But we are a globally interconnected community. And it is not just a throwaway saying that Dr. Tam has said repeatedly, that no one is protected unless everyone is protected. If it didn't matter who was vaccinated or not, then it wouldn't have mattered that there was one case identified in China, if you think of it that way. It mattered because people travel. We're a globally connected world. So even if we get a large portion of Canadians vaccinated, if it's still out of control in many areas of the world, that will absolutely impact us. The challenge that we're seeing is a severe inequity in access to vaccine. We have countries that have, even Canada, I believe that we've purchased enough, 4 times our population. United States is even higher. We are so blessed and lucky to be one of the wealthiest countries, developed countries, because we have access to this. And for anybody to say, I don't want to get vaccinated, there are people in other countries that are begging on their knees for access to vaccine. They're begging. The World Health Organization is begging for equity in distribution of vaccine. So not only is this a challenge in terms of supply chain and accessing people that are hard to reach, getting to everybody, you know, from the slums of India, who would look, make a homeless person in Canada look like a king, like the extreme differential between the richest and the poor are things that many of us can't imagine. The World Health Organization is saying if we could even reach a goal of 20% of the most vulnerable populations in every country, that that would be an extreme achievement. The latest data I saw from the World Health Organization is that 80%, more than 80% of vaccine that has been distributed is in the wealthiest countries, and fewer than 1% of residents in the poorest countries have been vaccinated. How does that make sense? This is this disease, the poorer you are, the closer together you are, the more you must rely on day-to-day work, because it's hand-to-mouth constantly. You are at the highest risk. And yet us in the wealthiest countries, we also have the even though we absolutely have risk, we're not at the same level of risk as those countries that are in extreme poverty, and yet we are the ones with the vaccine.
This Is Why is produced by me, Adam Toy, and Dave McIver. It's a national radio show and a podcast.
You can reach us by email at thisiswhy@globalnews.ca and on Twitter at thisiswhy.
If you like what you hear and want to hear more, make sure you subscribe to This Is Why so you never miss an episode. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And if you like what you're hearing, tell a friend.
Thanks for listening. Wash your hands, wear a mask, get vaccinated if you can, and stay home. We'll see you soon.
Hi. Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.